ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts.
JJ, I love having you on the show. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
But I guess it would be, well, hold on. It would be nice if you weren't inspiring every NBA player on the planet to start podcasting and eventually take my job.
I don't think people realize how big of a commitment podcasting is. It sounds, on the surface, it sounds awesome to have your own podcast and a platform where you can go on rants, which is somehow in my old age, that's what it's become. You know, it's obviously an interview, but I rant a lot. And
that's right.
And then you realize that you have to do it every week. You know, and that's where it becomes a problem. You know, 6 years ago when I started podcasting, if you had told me that this was the sort of the path and this was the route, I would have been like, yeah, I don't know. Should I not start doing it?
But this is why I was laughing, because you went viral as you do all the time now on ESPN. You're on First Take last week. You're eviscerating Chris Mad Dog Russo. And, you know, I enjoyed it. It was fun. It was funny. You had made great points, cutting, compassionate, all of that. But the whole premise of the topic was, JJ Redick, should Draymond Green stop talking so much?
Take a little umbrage with the shut up and play, because that has the same sort of connotations that the shut up and dribble crowd has towards athletes. And I have a real problem with that. And specifically with Draymond, the idea that America is tired of him. You do realize the guy has a very, very popular podcast that he hosts where he talks himself for a majority of the episode. Right. And people listen to that.
Asking J.J. Redick this question is like asking LeBron James, should all these athletes stop making television shows about free agency?
Yeah,
I was like, you're the guy who started all of this. You're the first one to do it.
You know, I think that perspective, I didn't even think about that. We're in a different era and a different age for not only athlete content, athlete-driven content like a Draymond Green podcast or like LeBron's The Decision, but the availability of athletes and the scrutiny in this social media era, 24/7 live television. I mean, you remember this when we were growing up, like you turn on ESPN and from pretty much 6 or 7 in the morning until 12 o'clock in the afternoon, there would be an hour Sports Center. And it would mostly be reruns. And occasionally there'd be, whatever. There'd be a breaking news story. And sometimes that would run on ESPN News. And then at 12 o'clock, we're going to go watch the Strongest Man in the World competition, right? But we're going to watch ESPN Classic basketball games, the 1985 Final Four.
Mm.
Like, there wasn't this amount of just discourse and dialogue about athletes all the time. So the idea, I guess, and this is not in reference to Chris Russo at all, but this idea that athletes should not have a voice and a platform in this new digital 24/7 world we live in is just, it seems a little asinine to me that we shouldn't also be able to participate in this new version of media.
Participating in sports media is not all that different from participating in these NBA playoffs. Let's be honest, right? Beyond the fact that athletes are doing all of these jobs now, this is all a very deeply theatrical enterprise, a performance, if you will, as much as anything. And you probably noticed it by now. A certain flailing of the arms, a very conspicuous swinging of the head, maybe even a grabbing of the face, anguished, just to make sure that your point is not just made, but acknowledged. So today, amid a postseason that is truly teeming with flopping of the highest caliber and the highest stakes, we bring you something special, a masterclass in the forum, taught by our friend JJ Redick, NBA veteran, veteran podcaster, and unapologetic practitioner of the dark arts of giving takes and drawing fouls, who cannot help but show us how it's done.
I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, May 11th. This is ESPN Daily.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So I want to start this conversation properly by just asking you to describe what exactly you saw near the end of Game 4 of the Warriors-Grizzlies series. I want to set the scene for you here a little bit because it's under 30 seconds left. It's a one-point game. We're under the Memphis basket and there is a scramble. And what happened felt emblematic to me of kind of the entire postseason. What did you see?
Well, again, there was an accentuation from Steph Curry on the physical contact. The little, I would call what Desmond Bane did a nudge. It was a nudge. Now, Steph Curry, and again, a lot of these nudges, if they happen a second prior, where he is not either just starting to jump or already in the air, then it's really hard to accentuate that in a way that doesn't just blatantly look like flopping.
Jackson back in on Green. Jackson up the rim, no. Rebound, it goes, Bane. A push.
Yeah, watch out.
Curry got shoved by Bane.
But when you're in that jumping motion and you get the nudge in your back, there's absolutely no way you can get the basketball. So in this scenario, by all means, flop away. Flop away. You know, there's no other option. Like, I've been there. There's no other option. And sometimes they don't call it.
But when you said that just now, sometimes they don't call it. You looked away and your voice just felt still very bitter, remembering your own attempts at getting those calls.
I hold on to things for a long time. I hold on to things
you don't
for
say.
A long
you
time.
Don't say.
Stephen A was complaining earlier on First Take about there's too many video reviews of calls and they should save them till the end. And you know, he's like, I bet you've never been screwed over by a video review. And I'm like, actually, 2014, Game 5, under 10 seconds, Reggie Jackson drives, Matt Barnes strips him. It clearly goes off Reggie Jackson's fingertips, and Tony Brothers clearly gives the ball back to OKC. We end up losing the game. Yeah, I've held on to that for the last 8 years. It's okay to hold on to things. I'm not bitter about them, but I like to remember things because it helps me contextualize everything. It really does. It really does. And on the flopping, I think it sort of segues into another topic I know you want to talk to me about, but I should mention as well with flopping. And when we talk about foul baiting, hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah.
But the two are sort of intertwined. And one of the things I've talked to about with Chris Paul, Joel Embiid, with Draymond as well on my podcast is, you know, these guys are so smart and there's rules in place. And so they sort of tweak body movements to draw attention to rules that are put in place to protect the offensive player. In Draymond's case, of course, probably rules put in place to protect the defensive player. So again, some of it is just taking advantage of the rule book, and we act, you know, we act.
JJ, you are acting like a real defense attorney's thesaurus right now. Accentuating movements, we're tweaking the rules. I mean, I want to get into the art and the psychology of the craft because I believe it is a craft. But I just want to sort of just get your sense of what we're watching in totality here first, like the big picture. Because it feels like, I mean, look, we're talking on a Tuesday afternoon. There are games tonight. I don't know how many flops we're going to see. But it feels like this NBA postseason is particularly shaped by the theatricality you're describing, the acting you're describing, and the controversies and arguments that ensue.
I don't think it's just native to this postseason. I think it's native to the NBA. And I'll give you an example. I'll just give you an example of why a basketball player should flop. So, again, this goes back to human nature if you're a referee. So a lot of a call versus a non-call is an advantage created by either the offensive player or the defensive player. So let's say Jason Tatum is driving on Drew Holiday, and Drew Holiday slides his feet. You know, he gets into a good position, and Jason Tatum extends his arm to create separation. If he extends his arm to create separation and shoots a step back jumper and Drew Holiday does not fall, it's probably likely more times than not that the referee is not going to blow his whistle. Now, if Drew Holiday accentuates that shove with a backwards motion and falls on his back, clearly the referee has to make a decision. Do I make the call? And more times than not, he's going to call the offensive foul. There's certainly charges and blocks where there's so much physical contact, you have no choice but to fall down. I get it.
Right.
But again, whether it's a Chris Paul rip through. And I used to do this as a player too. A lot of times, you know, I'm running off screens. And if I feel like I have an advantage to basically drive back into the defense because he's trying to chase me off the three, a lot of times his arm would come across my body and I would accentuate that motion. You know, I would maybe tuck my arm underneath. I would maybe throw my head back. You know, there's things you can do.
For the listener, when JJ is saying, when he's accentuating the word accentuate, he's using these very, like, beautiful, almost balletic kind of arm waves that are nothing like what actually is seen when you do accentuate in real life. So hold on, because you gave us sort of like a hit list, right, of some guys who are masters at this. And part of what I'm saying here to you is not like, man, flopping has arrived for the first time in the playoffs. Maybe it's simply that we're seeing some of the grand masters all in the semifinals at the same time, right? Chris Paul, Marcus Smart, James Harden, Kyle Lowry, Jay Crowder, Joel Embiid, John Morant, Luka Doncic, from like old to young. I guess I want to ask you here, just like of all of the names, all of the grand practitioners of the dark art, who is the one, JJ, that you marvel at the most of all these names?
I'm glad you brought up Marcus Smart. To me, Marcus has a PhD, whatever the highest level of education one could ever gain in the dark art of flopping.
An endowed professorship.
Flopping. I'm sorry for bringing up the podcast again, but it's just so close.
No.
It's so close and dear to my heart. We had Marcus on. We did a live podcast in Boston earlier this season to benefit Marcus's foundation. And during the show, we showed him a beautiful montage of some of his most egregious flops. And there was one, and this is why I'll bring it up again. It goes back to sort of putting the referee in a spot. There's one in the bubble. He's chasing down, I believe it was Pascal Siakam on a fast break. Pascal Siakam has a clear lane to the basket. And maybe Pascal Siakam was sort of blocking Marcus Smart's way. I can't remember. Anyways, somebody has a clear lane for the Raptors. And Marcus sees that there's no way he can make a play at the rim. So what he does is he runs into the other player who is blocking his path to contest the shot and then launches himself at the stanchion, at the basket. And the foul was called. And so we asked Marcus about this. And he said, well, I had no other choice. I had no other play. It was a playoff game. I had to do something. And again, let's say you're guarding, you're on defense, that Tatum example I brought up. If you're in a position where you've played legal defense and someone extends their arm and pushes you off balance, like to me, they'll never call it. They'll never call it if you don't fall down. So by all means, fall the f*** down.
It's worth noting, by the way, that Marcus Smart, and I loved that part of your pod, the old man in the three, everyone should be listening to it. I'm sure they are already. But I love that he is somebody that, I mean, you're not biased in his favor. I mean, this is somebody who has left you in stitches, both figuratively and also literally.
Yes, correct. He shot faked me on a 3-point attempt when I was with the Clippers right in front of our bench. And I didn't jump, but I leaned forward. So in an effort to draw the foul, again, I use the word launch again. I would describe he launched his upper body toward my body. And all he caught was my eye with his elbow.
And your elbow caught my eye.
I mean, you're a shooter. You understand it, right? We got it from you guys. You know, you got to learn. You know, you guys flop a lot when it's time to get the call, but you hate when guys flop against you.
And I had to get, I think it was 13 stitches, and I had a black eye. I actually went to the Duke UNC game like 3 days later, and I had a black eye, which was just fine, whatever. But
I'm sure the Carolina fans were like, whoever did this.
yeah. Thank God you. Bless. Yeah. God bless Marcus Smart. But I do think you have to do it at times. And it's I know there's complaints about it, but to me, it seems natural. Not everything. I'm not condoning all flopping, but I'm saying a lot of it is just about drawing attention to someone trying to gain an advantage on you. And if that advantage is illegal, let's draw as much attention as we can to the act.
Well, you are performing for an audience that is very specific. And it's not the audience that is the one that you hear from, because fans, everyone, commentators, they'll be aghast at it. It's for those referees, which is why I now need to show you, JJ. I need to turn the tables on you and do to you what you did to Marcus Smart.
Okay.
I'm going to show you a clip myself of yourself. Actually, do you know what clip I'm going to show you?
No.
I'm sure you
No, I don't. I don't? Ever I never flopped.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Hold on. I'm actually going to pull this and going to show it on my phone, because this is...
It's fine.
Yep. Hold on. That's my alert. Hold on. It's this one. Oh, here it is. Okay. I'm going to tilt my camera.
Ready. Inside the ring. Wow, are they going to call a foul on that?
Can you see any of this?
Boy, oh, yeah. Was doing cartwheels.
Yep.
On the sideline.
Yep. No, that's...
Yeah. J.J. Redick.
I know the play. Look,
yep. Does this... Sir, is this you? Sir?
Where's the foul?
So I'll sort of describe the play for the listener. So we're playing Atlanta. I've got a look at the basket from three, and Kent Bazemore does a really nice job, as he should, of running me off the line. Now, as he's running me off the line, I dribble inside the 3-point arc, and he wraps his arm around me as he goes by me when he runs me off. The referees do not call that foul. I thought it should have been called. It impeded my progress. And so when I went up to shoot, but 2 seconds later, I just flailed my entire body and shot an 18-footer about 14 feet.
One-handed. JJ, for again, the art of this, you resembled the Air Jordan logo. Both legs go out, one arm goes up, mid-range. And it's important to reiterate this, because this is why, incidentally, Sports Illustrated named this the 2015-2016 flop of the year.
Oh, wow.
Congratulations.
I didn't know I won that. I did win an award in the NBA. Fantastic.
But it's worth reiterating this. This was 2 seconds after the infraction that you're now alleging. And so Kent Bazemore is staring at you. And Mike Budenholzer is his face. I can't even begin to describe the mixture of just like impressed and furious that one man could be simultaneously.
You know, it's plays like that made the NBA institute the review. That's right. You know what I mean?
You were literally feet away from Kent Bazemore, and your acting was so good that the ref in question missed it or made the call, having missed the reality of the call, and the NBA then, what, did escalating fines for repeat offenders to deter recidivists like yourself? What happened?
Yes, I never got actually fined. I had a warning one time when I was in Milwaukee. This was a few years earlier. So maybe the rule was, no, the flapping rule was in place. I don't know if the review was in place, the challenge that each coach is allowed in 2015, 2016. But in 2012, 2013, during my brief tenure with the Bucks, we were playing the Oklahoma City Thunder late in the regular season. And Derek Fisher closed out on me. And he ran me off the line. And as I'm sort of trying to drive by him, my face hit his shoulder. Now, Derek Fisher, he's a solid guy. So it definitely felt like maybe it could have been a foul, but I just crumpled to the floor. And they called a foul. And at the time, I believe Derek Fisher was the head of the union. So I was like, I'm going to get a call on this. And sure enough, you know, I got a call. The other one that I think, you know, for me as a shooter, like if you're in my airspace, you know, I would draw attention to the fact that you were in my airspace. So a lot of times I would just hit the deck. You know, I'd hit the deck. And there was one in against Boston.
A no-fly zone is what you wanted around you.
Exactly. And Avery Bradley closed out on me in the air as I'm shooting. And he gently, his jersey just so slightly touched my jersey. There was no body contact, but
vague fabric-based friction was enough for you.
Fabric-based friction. Exactly. It threw my shot off. And so I fell. They called the foul. And then 2 days later, I got a warning for that as well. You know, the word you used, and I'm going to go back to something you said, the word you used about performance. And I think that's so interesting to think of athletes. Obviously, we're competing, but there's an element of being on stage. And my wife used to always make fun of me, whether it was a flop or, you know, if I took a charge and, you know, I would just like, you know, lay on the ground in so much pain, or if I got hit in the head. You know, I've seen guys who a shot is contested and somebody in a rear view contest will, like Tyler Herro did this the other day, someone touched his hair while he shot. And then for the next 5 minutes, he's touching the top of his head, looking for blood.
JJ, that is method acting. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's Daniel. You are a form of Daniel Day-Lewis.
You just got to be in character, Pablo. That's all it comes down to. You got to be in character.
Yes. So, JJ, after the break, I want to go even further inside the Flopper's studio with you, and I want to find out who taught you to play this role.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
The logical question, by the way, right? Like Mike Budenholzer, the guy who the coach who was aghast at you doing this at your character, he now is watching Giannis flop against Peyton Pritchard, you know, who's 6'1" in game four of the Celtics-Bucks series. No one, like, as much as this is something that I'm going to drill down on with you, it's happening all over the place. And I guess what I'm curious about is the performance art aspect of it, the method, the technique. Where did you learn this? Who taught you?
That's a great question. I think it's just gained knowledge over time. I'll be honest, and I would tell referees this that would get mad at me, like, I'm not going to call that foul. You know, he wasn't in your landing area. I would sometimes kick my legs out. And it was because over time, it happens 3 or 4 times where you don't kick your legs out and you land on someone's foot and you sprain your ankle and you're out for 2 weeks. Like, I just would avoid that. And I would tell referees that, like, it's fine if you don't call it. Just know I'm not, that's not an actual flop. I just don't want to sprain my ankle. So some of it was that. And then, you know, it's like positive reinforcement with the referees. Go back to the Tatum thing. So if I'm playing a game against, I'm 13 years old in AAU and I'm, 6'3", 150 pounds, and I'm playing against a much stronger player and he's using his off arm to push off time and time again, and they're not calling it. Well, at some point, if I fall and I get the charge, the offensive foul called, then I'm saying, oh, that works. That works. It's the same thing if somebody's in my airspace and I fall down. I'm like, oh, that works.
This is JJ Redick telling the referees, I learned it from you, Dad. I learned it from you. You're the ones who convinced me that this is actually, by the way, in your defense, an effective strategy.
Well, Reggie Miller was a guy that I watched a ton of tape of. When he would run floppy action, so catch and shoot stuff, he would start on a dead sprint. And then if the guy was sprinting with him and was on his rear, he would just stop and the guy would run into him and he would launch himself forward and they'd call a foul.
Brilliant.
I'm like, oh, that's a good strategy. And then there was other times where Reggie would be running off the screen and the guy would be on his high side this time. And as he got to the screen, he would just grab his arm. So as he came off the screen, it looked like he was being held. And I used this to my advantage quite a bit at Duke. I shot a lot of free throws.
Yeah.
Once I learned how to do this effectively. And I remember my rookie year, we were playing in a game at Charlotte and I tried the move. And one of the referees whose son at the time was a college referee said to me, I've watched your games in college. I'm not going to give you that f-ing call. I know what you're doing. It doesn't always work.
He's like, there's a wanted poster in the ref's like dressing room and your face is all over it. I mean, but the coaches, JJ, like part of the art that you're describing, right? Something that's emulated by watching others. It doesn't seem like there's formal instruction, in other words. Like, are coaches saying anything about this? Are they encouraging or discouraging or providing any sort of counsel as you're sort of figuring out how to do this stuff?
I don't think there's anybody that's ever said to Marcus Smart, Marcus, stop doing that. Like, I don't think any of his coaches are doing that. I would say it's the opposite. It's more like the teams and the coaches can send in tape after a game to the league. And so they'll send in tape about a guy's tactics. We'll call them tactics. A guy's tactics to draw fouls. Mm. And, you know, the more that reputation is attached to a player, then the more referees are aware of it. And the referees, of course, are professionals and they're prepared. So they'll go into every game and they'll huddle up before the game and they'll say, okay, we got Marcus Smart tonight. Let's just be aware of the fact that he may try to flop. They're very aware of their, but they're human beings. And so in the moment, again, as method actors, like in the moment, it seems real. It seems real. And it's hard for the referee to distinguish between real and fake.
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, I don't envy this at all. I mean, we have the benefit, again, to go back to the slow motion replay of like seeing it from every angle a million times to evaluate it. But meanwhile, I want to bring in the overseas aspect here, JJ, because listening to you talk to Marcus, I believe, said that he got it. He learned it from the overseas guys initially. And obviously Europe, that's part of their tactics. I'll borrow your synonym here. Is that how you also understand the globalization of flopping here? How much of that is part of the story, the international aspect of it?
Yeah, I was joking with Legs earlier. I don't remember there being as much when I was watching games in the 90s.
Same.
No, I really don't, other than Reggie Miller. And again, he's, to me, one of the greatest method actors of all time.
De Niro and Raging Bull.
De Niro.
It's him and him. Yeah.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah,
of course. No, but the overseas players, we talk about that sort of attacking a closeout where you are attacking a guy's high shoulder and there's like chest to chest contact. And those European guys would always throw their head back. They'd always throw their head back when that happened. Mm. You know, Patrick Beverley on the pod was talking about the challenges of guarding Luka. And he said he's unique in that he's simultaneously extremely physical and uses his body, but also flops. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like this two-prong challenge when you guard Luka.
The quote specifically was he's physical as and flops at the same time, which is the same thing that I do.
Which is the same thing that I do.
Which is again kind of like Brando complimenting DiCaprio.
Exactly.
Yeah. In this inside the flopper studio that we're now assembling here. But JJ, you know, the craft also is something that is practiced then, I assume. Right? I'm told actually that you are somebody who enjoys the rehearsal as much as the game. How do they fit into your practice regime?
Did you have some information about me that I didn't know was public?
No, well, I may have been at the Sloan conference.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. That makes sense.
And I maybe saw Sue Bird pantomime what she was told about how you rehearse your tactics. I'm a reporter, JJ. That's the difference between me and you, a jock.
Right. So Sue knows Ross and Tim Burns, who trained me on the court. They were my on-court trainers my last 4 years of my career. And I had done this for a long time, but let's say I'm shooting 5 step-up threes on the right wing off the dribble. On that fifth one, I would pantomime. Yeah, I would practice shooting basically the Kent Bazemore shot. Basically the Kent Bazemore shot. And I swear to God, when I would do it in the offseason, I'd even do it sometimes, you know, after shoot arounds or after practice when I would do my routine. Like, again, I'm doing a drill and I've got to make 5 or I've got to make 7, I've got to make 10. And I would mix in a couple very egregious flop makes. But yes, I practice those shots.
This is where, JJ, this is where I have to tip my cap. I mean, I watched that Kent Bazemore play and I was like, clearly this is a spontaneous kind of like spasmic reaction. I didn't realize you had been in the lab practicing. That is a dedication I had never fathomed.
Well, but like my wife always says, it's the 5 P's. Prior preparation prevents poor performance. Like, it's all preparing you for moments that you're going to see in a game. And truthfully, I'm not just saying this. There are times where you go up to shoot and someone hits you on your wrist when you're in your shooting motion or slaps down to get the ball and they catch your forearm. And that's really the only shot you can take. Now, you could just go straight up and shoot it.
You could.
But again, they probably wouldn't call the foul.
But also, you wouldn't be able to reveal that you're almost like this crouching tiger, hidden dragon level stuntman.
Yes, exactly.
But the body control, the athleticism, the sense of yourself in the air, in space, it is actually, I mean, there is athleticism here, JJ. And I get a sense now of the craft that you're describing, but we're now at the point of the pod where I sort of begin to feel like I'm talking to you through the glass of like your prison cell and you're like Hannibal Lecter. And I'm just like, why are you like this?
I go back to Chris. I'll go back to Chris on this. CP, I've known and played with a lot of psychotic players. I would describe them as sickos.
Sick f***s, I believe, is the term of art that you pioneered on your pod.
Yes. And Chris is sort of the ultimate one. And if I had to distill Chris down to a single description, it would be that Chris is looking to gain an advantage and squeeze the juice out of every possession. And so part of that is knowing the rule books. Part of that is knowing defenders' tendencies. Part of that is knowing when a defense is in a vulnerable spot. And he brought this up on the podcast where he talked about, you know, if he's on the right wing or the left wing and he's waiting on that pick and roll and he's got a live dribble, so he's got his pivot foot ready to go, and the other team is running a down or an ice, whatever you want to call it, and they're going to force it to the baseline, he's like, the defense is taught wrong. The defense is taught to put an arm bar on your hip. Well, if I rip through, your arm is in the way.
Yep.
So it's just, it's ultimately like looking for that advantage.
Knowledge of the tax code as well as acting.
Yes. For me personally, it was always like, how do I use my shooting as an advantage? I know people are going to close to me different than they would close to Matisse Thybulle. there's going to be a greater sense of urgency, which means a lot of times they're going to be lunging forward. And I naturally shoot jumping forward. I've done that my whole life. So I knew that Jamal Crawford was so good at this. He could sense when someone was going to be in his airspace the second he went up for a shot. And he had just this uncanny ability to time it perfectly, where he would just be dribbling the ball and all of a sudden he'd shoot. And it's like, well, that's a foul. You can't be in someone's airspace like that. So again, it's just, you're like just trying to find an advantage. You're trying to squeeze the juice out of every possession.
So what you're saying in so many words is that you, JJ, are also a sicko.
Yeah. Yeah. I am hopefully decently self-aware, and I'm self-aware enough to know that had it not been for me being a sicko myself, I would not have had the career I had. I certainly could shoot the ball well, but I had to figure out so many different little nuances and little ways to get an advantage. I mean, it goes back to defense. Like, I knew, like, I have a 6'2.5" wingspan at a 6'4". So generally speaking, I can play great defense. I can stay in front of someone, but a lot of players are just going to shoot right over me. So if I'm guarding someone, they're going off the dribble and they initiate contact into my chest, I'm going down. I'm going down every time. You know, most of the teams I was on, I was either the leading charge taker or the second leading charge taker. I'm going down.
What a specific NBA insecurity. I'm 6'4" and my wingspan is less than my height. I'm a freak. Yeah. Look at me. I'm a freak. But hold on, because the defense aspect of this, right? Like, something that's astounding to me, Marcus Smart is literally the defensive player of the year. Chris Paul is 7 times first team all defense. Kyle Lowry's excellent. Like, these guys, you could argue, are not like you in that way. Mm-hmm. They
are better.
Don't need it. I imagine that is all the more infuriating when you're the guy who they flop against and you're like, come on. What am I supposed to do here?
Yeah. You know it's coming. And I think of Chris, there was that play in this series. It was right in front of the bench on the left corner where he did the rip through on a closeout. And the guy sort of, as he's dribbling by him, the guy put his hands on him and he jumps in the air and he flails his body everywhere. And he shoots a little runner off the glass and it went in.
Paul drives, puts it up off the window and in. He wanted the contact and the foul, didn't get the call.
It's one of those ones that NBA tried to address this year where you're really shooting the ball to get the foul call, not to make it. Chris Paul's good enough to do both.
Again, you went back to the athleticism and the concentration required to pull off a stunt like that. It's almost deflating as an opponent, right? Because you know it's coming.
Yes.
You know it's coming. I feel bad every game that I watch Chris Paul play when he gets his rip through. Because I'm like, that was talked about. I've played against Chris. I've been his teammate.
Yep.
That was talked about 7 times today. It was certainly talked about multiple times in the morning. It was talked about pregame. It was talked about in a huddle during the game. Like, you're just always aware of it. And when it happens, it's just deflating.
Now, this is like when a company hires a white hat hacker to help them build their information security. It's like, you've been the guy causing us all of these problems. How do we fortify our own protections against the tactics that are being perpetrated? How can you possibly defend against this?
I think the natural inclination for facing someone who is willing to go to an extreme is to go to an extreme yourself. And the greatest example I can think of in recent memory is the year the Utah Jazz played the Houston Rockets in the playoffs, and they literally had their guys basically humping James Harden from behind. Like, they were giving him the basket. They were saying, please go to the basket. We're not going to let you shoot a step by three. And you're not going to grab our arm on your drive. You're going to have to make 15 floaters every game over Gobert. Like, that was crazy.
I remember this now. They were basically like perpendicularly defending him.
The worst body position.
No room for the Holy Ghost either.
You remember when Patty Mills and the Spurs would play against James Harden? Patty Mills every defensive possession for all 24 seconds would just walk around with his arms up like, yes. You're not going to get me. You're not going to get
me. Not shoplifting, officer. My hands are in the air. You know that I'm not trying to draw a foul right now. I love the idea of to defeat a sicko, you must become a sicko. I'm kind of into that.
Yes, exactly.
But I guess if you're the people making the calls, is there anything the NBA that the officials can do to be better at detecting when they're being worked?
Well, I think they do a good job. And with the rule changes this year, Trae Young, you know, is an example of someone launching themselves back. You go over a screen, he's got drop coverage. The second you scurry over that pick because you're not going under against Trae Young, he launches himself backwards and you foul his butt. Like, they got rid of that. Okay, it's a non-basketball move.
Butt fouls have plummeted since the new emphasis has been declared.
James Harden driving and you've got a legal arm bar and he takes his offhand that he's not dribbling with and goes underneath your arm and then tries to collect the ball. How many times have we seen him do that this year and them not call
it? A lot.
Them not call it. So they are great at it. I think my question to you and to just fans in general, we'll go back to the beginning of where we started this conversation. The Desmond Bane play with Steph Curry. My question to you is, was that a foul on Desmond Bane? And if the answer is no, then I think you're wrong. I think that was a foul on Desmond Bane. So yes, Steph Curry flopped, but it was still a foul. Those calls should be called 100% of the time.
So my answer to you at the very end here is that no, it's not a foul, but I'm more interested in you because I don't think you care. I think the fact that it's not a foul, but that it became one is actually kind of perversely, not even kind of, it's straight up perversely satisfying to you.
Oh, man. You're not wrong on that. You're not wrong on that. No, you're not. Again, I don't know if it's competitiveness. I don't know if it's gamesmanship. You're not tricking the ref because it did become a foul. Whether it would have been or not had he not flopped, it did become a foul. So in that way, you have won. That advantage that you were looking for, you have found it. You have found the treasure on that possession and you've won.
You saw the letter of the law and you're like, no. And you remade it live on the court.
Yes, in real time. You love it.
JJ Redick, noted sicko, thank you for joining us and bearing your soul.
Always fun. Always fun. Always enjoy it.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.